Não.
Thank you, Ryan. Also saying welcome everyone to the August meeting of the Fair Housing Advocacy Committee. If you don't know me, my name is Nikki Gillespie and I'm Bureau staff support for this advisory body. We will begin by doing the roll call. And when your name is called, please unmute and just indicate that you are present. We'll start with Ashley Miller.
Present.
Thank you, Ashley. Rachel Nessie.
Present.
Thank you, Rachel. Lauren Wade. Taylor Smiley Wolf.
Present.
Taylor Ada Jimenez. Alan Lazo.
Present.
Barbara, if you could indicate you're present again. I can't hear you, Barbara, but I did hear you earlier, so I'll go ahead and mark that as present.
This is Barbara. I'm here. Thank you. Sorry.
No worries. Becky Strauss.
Here.
Becky Young Ho.
Present.
Ellen Tolan. Holly Stevens. Jamila Rutherford Tai. Mara Romero.
Here.
Marisa Espinosa.
Hello, present.
Vera Warren. And lastly, May Chop. Okay, thank you. We did have enough committee members here to meet quorum, so the meeting is officially called to order. Ryan has our agenda up here on the screen. You should have also received a copy of it yesterday via email. I am just gonna do a quick review of the agenda before we get started. We do have a few updates and housekeeping items that I will begin with, followed by two different presentations. And there should be time for any questions and discussion that's built into the time slot for each presentation. For any members of the community that are in attendance, thank you for joining us today. And we do have a public comment period that's scheduled at 4:15 p.m. and we look forward to hearing from you at that time. After public comment, Matthew Schabold is going to give us a brief update on fair housing planning moving forward. But before launching into the agenda items, Matthew and the Bureau would like to do a quick introduction of our newest manager to the committee members. So I will pass it off to Matthew.
All right, thank you, Nikki. Good afternoon, members of FHEC. So I am pleased to introduce our new rental services manager, Breon D. Decker. Breon has been with us since the spring, but we haven't had an FHEC meeting. And she comes to us from Louisiana and has a great depth of experience in anti-displacement work, affordable housing, landlord-tenant, and fair housing. And so I'm going to pass it over to Breon to introduce herself, but we're very fortunate to have her, and she is, she's taking on a lot in her first 6 months here on the job, and we appreciate that, and you'll be engaging with her as well as Nikki as you move forward. So with that, Breon.
Hi, folks. Good afternoon. I'm really excited to be here. I see a lot of familiar faces and names and some unfamiliar ones. So as Matt mentioned, I come to Portland from New Orleans, Louisiana, where I did work around permanent affordability, community land trusts, disaster and resiliency planning, and tenant rights. I'm very excited to be in Portland, and I'm looking forward to supporting the extremely important work of this advisory committee. So thank you so much. I'm looking forward to learning from all of you.
Thank you, Brianna. And thank you, Matthew, for the introduction. Okay, give me one moment just to share my screen. All if I could get a few thumbs up just to make sure everybody can see that slide. Great, awesome.
Yep.
Okay, a few housekeeping items. Two of them revolve around some updates from HUD. So the first, I'm going to give just a real brief overview of this, and Matthew will come back in towards the end of our meeting and provide more details. But we did get some updated guidance from HUD regarding requirements around affirmatively furthering fair housing. So there is a new interim rule, and the 2021 interim rule is titled Restoring Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Definitions and Certifications. As anticipated, it is moving us back to the standards around a more comprehensive fair housing planning process. At this time, the fair housing planning process is voluntary, but it did reinstate some HUD technical assistance and support for jurisdictions that would like to engage in that work. Matt will come back and talk to us about the impacts and implications, what that means for us and what that means for this committee. The second piece from HUD is regarding the disparate impact rule. So the disparate impact rule is also known as the discriminatory effects rule. And similar to the AFFH housing rules, you know, the last administration made some changes here. I know many of you are probably familiar, but for the benefit of anyone who's not, I'm just going to give some brief background. So this rule is what allows cases of fair housing violations to be brought forward if a policy has discriminatory effects on a protected class, and it doesn't serve any sort of substantial or legitimate non-discriminatory interest, or if there is some sort of other less discriminatory alternative policy that could be put in place that hasn't been enacted. So in 2020, the changes from the last administration made it harder to establish that the policy had that discriminatory effect, and it also created multiple new defenses that somebody could use against a claim. So the update that I have for you today is that HUD is proposing a return on this front as well, back to the 2013 standard. Currently, it is at the end of a 60-day public comment period, but again, kind of looking. The indication is that it will be restored back to the Obama-era administration policies and standards. Additionally, we did have one committee member resign since our last April meeting. So I wanted to let you all know that we do have a vacancy, and I will be working on outreach and recruitment for a new committee member. We will be reaching out to a lot of our community organizations, including a large list of culturally specific organizations, in order to recruit for this committee member. But I want to offer you all an opportunity to shoot me an email if you feel like there's a specific organization you want to make sure is included. Do send that to me, and I will make sure that they're on a list. If you have a specific contact, all the better. Once that outreach plan is completed and there actually is a posting, I will forward that to all the committee members as well. So you'll have a second opportunity to share that with your networks or ensure that you show it to a colleague or someone that you'd like to potentially put in an application and be a committee member. I'll give you an update on that as well at the next meeting in terms of how that is going and where we're at with that recruitment process, but it is one vacancy for the community at large. And also, it's been just, I feel like, kind of a quick, we're almost hitting a year, but with these quarterly meetings, they seem to just be like ticking right by. And after everybody got appointed, we had those first initial few meetings. At this point, we haven't actually picked a committee chair or a vice chair. So that is something that needs to be done. And so I would like to ask all of you that may be interested in filling one of those positions to shoot me an email and let me know of your interest. And I will compile a list of interested committee members that will be available for the Bureau Director's review and final selection. The committee chair and the vice chair will help assist Bureau staff in setting work plans and agendas, as well as managing and facilitating the meetings moving forward. So, please, if you have any interest whatsoever, send me an email and let me know. I don't want to volunteer anyone on their behalf. So please let me know. Finally, the next meeting that we have scheduled is on Tuesday, October 12th, 2021. Please keep an eye on your inbox and Ryan will be sending that event invite as well as the Zoom details and information for you to register. Does anybody have any questions on the updates? Feel free to unmute. Okay, well, I will just move us along. The next item on our agenda is to review the first section, subsection A, the table of recommendations from that 2011 analysis of impediments of fair housing choice. So if we kind of reach back to April at our last meeting, I had put together a table for you guys that listed all of the recommendations from the 2011 report analysis. And I gave you a brief overview of, you know, actions or programs or whether that recommendation had any movement on it over the last decade. It was very high level and kind of just giving you a yes or no. When we were discussing how we wanted to move forward and what type of approach that you guys would like to take in terms of getting more information and in terms of thinking about where these recommendations were, I heard that we wanted to start back at the top of that table and dig in a little bit deeper and then potentially make comments, have questions, or mark whether we thought recommendations were still appropriate or needed clarification. I'm going to start with the first four items that were in subsection A. The first item was to commit funding and support to the education of fair housing laws. The second is to commit funding and support of enforcement of fair housing laws. The third is to conduct audit testing to document discrimination. And the fourth is to partner with housing providers to modify screening and credit criteria, such as requiring of social security numbers that have an inadvertent impact on protected classes. For this presentation, I'm just gonna give you a little bit more detail for items 1, 2, and 4. Item 3 regarding audit testing, we'll actually address at the next meeting. The Fair Housing Council of Oregon, the plan is that we will be providing more information about what audit testing looks like and their findings on their report from testing from this last fiscal year. So rather than get into that today, we already have that slated for our next meeting. So let's start with just kind of education and enforcement. Last time I told you, you know, yes, we have contracts for that. So here, what does that look like? What types of services are available in the jurisdiction? And here is, again, still pretty high level, but to kind of give you a little bit more understanding and context around what are those services, what has been implemented and what has continued to be supported since the 2011 recommendations. We have direct classes that are available to tenants and landlords. These are free of charge. They are conducted by community partners and community-based organizations. Some of these, you know, are going to cover specific subjects within landlord-tenant law in a more general sense, but all of them are going to have fair housing elements and general fair housing education available in them as well. We have call line services in a similar fashion. Some of these call lines are just generally available for housing providers and for tenants, but they can flag fair housing issues and make referrals over to intake services that are fair housing specific. There are trainings and educational sessions provided to other housing and social service organizations within the jurisdiction to ensure that housing counselors, housing providers, and those working within the housing community have information on fair housing law. We have workshops, fairs, and events, obviously, that are being put on by various different organizations that focus on elements of fair housing and have resources related to fair housing as well. Culturally specific supports and connection to fair housing enforcement. We have services that are designed to provide that additional layer to folks that have a disconnect from dominant culture to assist them through what can be a bit of a tedious process and a lot of different administrative processes around various organizations. So having a support person in culturally specific services has been addressed in that narrow way. Beyond that, there's extended legal service, legal assistance and representation for community members that are dealing with fair housing issues. In terms of modifying screening and credit criteria, this has had quite a bit of movement since 2011 when these recommendations were written. I know quite a few committee members are probably very familiar with what I'm about to talk about. But again, giving high level overviews of what has happened in terms of policy around screening credit criteria for rentals. The earliest change that we saw in this regard that was a major overhaul is within Portland City Code. And it was an ordinance that adjusted requirements around application and screening criteria. This was within the City of Portland, also known as the FAIR ordinances. This was one piece of that two-piece package of policy. This is, you know, there's a lot of pieces and parts if you read this code, but I'm just hitting a few of the points that address most directly the fair housing concerns that I saw reflected within the analysis. The first is that any posting of a unit available for rent that's made to the public needs to indicate whether that unit is type A accessible. And type A accessible means that it's designed and accessible for wheelchair users. It mandates a first come first serve policy for most publicly advertised units. There's a few exemptions there, but for everyone else, it's the first come first serve. The caveat being that mobility disabled community members are prioritized for accessible units. Okay, so there's a matching process there. And again, it's indicated within the advertisement for any rental units as well. Multiple forms of ID or combination of ID has to be accepted by housing providers in order to establish identity. A landlord cannot reject an application as incomplete due to the lack of a social security number being provided by an applicant. It created a tenant right to submit supplemental evidence to mitigate negative screening results. So what that means is that an applicant can submit a variety of different types of documentation that they feel might provide context or otherwise mitigate issues that a housing provider may see while they're doing the screening. That could be related to their credit history, it could be related to criminal history, or it could be related to their rental history. It also, in terms of criminal history issues, requires that a housing provider does a consideration of that supplemental evidence that's provided and an individualized assessment before denial. And all these elements are part of Portland City Code in application and screening. On the state level, more recently, some of that has actually been mirrored within ORS 90. Senate Bill 291 amended ORS 90, and these changes will go into effect January 1st, 2022. It requires that a statement of denial with the reasons for denial are provided to applicants within 14 days rather than being provided upon request, again, statewide. It has limitations on considering previous arrests. Whatever the conduct was that led to the arrest must presently be legal in Oregon. And a housing provider cannot consider any pending charges. If that applicant is participating in something like a diversion program, there's a conditional discharge, or there's a deferral program that they're working through. Criminal history issues, again, require a landlord to consider supplemental evidence and conduct individualized assessments before denial. So all these pieces kind of going back and connecting to that recommendation from 2011, movements in the local jurisdiction as well as statewide. Finally, there are some things that I felt were relevant specifically to the credit criteria and screening when it came to COVID. I expect a lot of us also know this, and these aren't necessarily long-term systemic changes that are happening, but things that do mitigate COVID-specific impacts that tenants may have experienced. The landlord cannot report a tenant's non-payment of rent, charges, or fees that were accrued during what's considered to be the emergency period of COVID-19. Those dates are April 1st, 2020 and July 1st, 2021. None of that can be reported to a credit reporting agency. The landlord cannot consider eviction claims that arose between April 1st, 2020 through March 1st, 2022. That will be after the repayment period has finished. And the landlord cannot consider an applicant's unpaid rents, including rent reflected in judgments that accrued during this time as well. Again, COVID specific, but touching on that rental history and that credit history for applicants in terms of fair housing. So with that, does anyone have any questions about those items presented? Or comments or general discussion?
I have a question. I'm not sure if we're gonna get into this right away, but well, thank you first of all for the presentation. I think what I'm seeing as far as like the slides that talk about modifying screening and credit criteria, there's just so much in there that's been really, I think, helpful for tenants. It makes me wonder about where our current fair housing education and enforcement includes some of those changes, specifically around the fair ordinance. I just feel like that's kind of been, I mean, it's too bad that it kind of went into effect right at the beginning of the pandemic. Obviously that's a problem, but how do we kind of address that is what comes to mind for me.
Yes, that is part of the education. When I was kind of talking about that more general landlord tenant, those subjects are definitely included in the educational offerings, especially large focus, as well as kind of more jurisdictional policies like relocation assistance and the security deposits. And that would be in addition to general fair housing information about protected classes, source of income, what to do if you believe you've experienced discrimination. That general fair housing information is incorporated in the classes. In terms of looking at FAIR, it is often presented as subject specific because there's a lot of information too. I'm sure numbers, since it's not even reflected on that slide, it's quite a bit to get through. But those resources are available. Additionally, for folks in terms of 086, we have, you know, the Rental Services Office hotline for landlords and tenants to contact. We have translated materials available on our website and brochures on application and screening. I believe it's about a 20-page booklet that covers everything, and we have it translated into 9 other languages. That said, it's interesting, Ruth. I don't know of anything at this point yet that covers those statewide changes. It will be interesting to see what is available for folks to build some awareness around that, especially when that's the coverage that they're getting in terms of supplemental evidence and individualized assessments.
Vicki and Marisa, thanks for that question. One of the things I'd say about, you know, for us in the fair housing trainings that we do, much of what's reflected in both the FAIR ordinance and in SB 291, especially around the use of criminal history and screening criteria, are elements that are part of, you know, what we think are the federal guidelines around use, for instance, use of criminal history, you know, accepting alternative forms of ID other than social security numbers. So they're not necessarily specific to those two ordinances. They, you know, we think they are both part of federal fair housing law and best practices. So we tend to train on those. We have trainings that we do specifically around use of criminal history at that level also. But we don't train specifically on the fair ordinance because there's also a really high percentage of that that is related to landlord-tenant law. And I know that there's a team of folks at PHB that are doing fair ordinance specific trainings in the community right now also.
If I can respond to that, thank you, Alan. I guess part of my question too is about like enforcement as well, because I know that that's one of the hardest things to do, obviously, and, you know, providing not even just actual legal representation in court, but just legal advice can be so difficult. I'm wondering, how does that figure into this picture as well? So for example, like, I'll just give an example from where I'm at as a social service provider that's connecting folks to existing housing resources. When we see a housing provider that we believe is not exempt from FAIR, obviously we do our due diligence to try to educate them about that, but we can't necessarily be the ones to tell them, hey, you need to be providing these materials in your application, you cannot screen in this way, et cetera. And I'm just kind of wondering, like, to what rate, you know, services through the rental services office are utilized in that vein and or could be expanded, you know, just to ensure that, like, at the point of contact, we are seeing that enforcement happen when not just folks being aware of them, but when we see potential, like, lack of compliance with those rules.
Thank you, Marisa. I know that is a question that comes up a lot because our zones were not an enforcement agency. I still make note of it. And I think that question of enforcement is a great one. I also want to make sure, I know Mara, you've had your hand up for a while. And then after Mara, if we could let Taylor have a moment as well.
Thank you. I was actually just going to touch a little bit on what we've been talking about. And I was just going to add that I appreciate the Portland Housing Bureau's trainings that they do offer around this. I know there haven't been some since like May or so of this year. And one of the things I really like about them is that they're geared towards different audiences, which I think is really important. Like, they're geared towards either a landlord, geared towards a case manager, geared towards a tenant. And that way we all kind of understand, because yeah, I mean, you know, as a social worker, I walk a fine line every day around legal advice and not giving that. So, you know, as if you do fair housing work and you work around the landlord tenant law, it's really hard sometimes to feel like you can give people good information about how to advocate for themselves without getting them in danger. So again, having that perspective of like, what do you have the right to do? What can you do? What should you say in the moment? You know, not just reporting, but also how can we prevent folks from being denied housing in the moment instead of just reporting on it? Thanks for bringing that issue up.
Thank you, Mara. Taylor?
Sorry, I was struggling to unmute there. I just wanted to agree with what Alan said around the sort of application of the federal guidance around screening criteria and criminal background in particular, and just share that, you know, when Home Forward was implementing the FAIR ordinance, we used that as an opportunity to both significantly reduce look back periods beyond the low barrier screening criteria and move to universal IAs, individual assessments as well. So there's outside of the two HUD sort of permanent bans for folks, there folks always have an IA performed, and we significantly reduce those. And I share that because I know with the application of Senate Bill 291, it's possible that landlords may no longer do or may avoid the low barrier path. I'm not sure in terms of the lower look back period, since they have to do the IA anyway. And so I was just curious if the city or leaders in the city are considering revisiting the FAIR ordinance and requiring both the IA and the lower look back period.
I don't have any comments on that right now, but it's definitely a question I will ask Taylor and put anything back. Becky?
On that question, and apologies for kind of, I'm in on two different screens right now, in two different places, so sorry about that. I just, on that topic, we've talked about whether there's opportunity to really assess what's going on with FAIR. Like, kind of picking up on Taylor's question, and maybe I'm seeing Molly in the room. I would love some perspective and don't have any way of getting it on what's happening with landlords in terms of whether they're implementing a low barrier option for people or whether they're consistently sticking with their own criteria and doing an individualized assessment. I think some of that kind of context might help figure out, would we want to advocate that council revisit the FAIR ordinance, or how are we integrating Senate Bill 291? Kind of all those questions. I feel like I'm lacking a lot of context that I don't know where to get those other than anecdote from some of our partners.
Yeah, I don't know of anything formal in regards to that, Becky, that's been put out, like any sort of data report around that. I do know that it's a question that has been asked in terms of looking at the impact on FAIR, and it's definitely, I'm noting it down, and I will see if I can have something that's within that realm to bring back to you. The other part in terms of integrating Senate 291, I think kind of couples with Taylor's question too, and I'll see what I can find out. Any other questions or comments?
This is Mara. I was just going to respond to that quickly and say that I think, yeah, FAIR has been pretty overshadowed by COVID, and it has been hard to kind of get a grip on it as just a housing advocate and a social worker in the community. A lot of it's been helping landlords understand this other piece that's been going on. And when the FAIR stuff comes up around the screening, it doesn't really sound like people have really developed any systems or organization around it. But definitely people have been receptive and open to changing policies based on once they learn. But yeah, it's mostly been very overshadowed by COVID.
I think that's a great point. I think, you know, even looking at the market, just speaking personally, right, everyone's saying it's very hard to assess what's going on at all right now or to use anything as a basis because of all the impacts that COVID has had. And given that FAIR and COVID were implementing it at pretty much the exact same time of March 2020, that may be a barrier to analysis. So let's flag that as well. I think that's a great point. Okay, the next item on our agenda is an enforcement overview. So again, based on the meeting in April, feedback that I received is that we would like more information and grounding in just what enforcement looks like, mechanisms for enforcement, and from a community member's perspective, what that process may look like. The Fair Housing Council of Oregon has graciously volunteered to provide a presentation for us and their expertise. We have Kirsten Bloom available. I know you're a few minutes early, Kirsten. I hope you don't mind calling on you.
No, that's great. Yeah, and I'm also joined by, who knows, our executive director, Alan Lazo, who's adding some content here. And then Honor Bon Paul, our testing coordinator, will be joining us too. So thanks, Nikki. Thanks for having us to speak to enforcement activity in the city of Portland area and throughout the state. We're happy to be able to provide this context to you all. So just to give you some grounding, I'd love to start by just sharing a bit more about the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. We're a statewide civil rights organization that works to promote justice, equity, and inclusion in housing in Oregon. And our mission is to end housing discrimination throughout the state. And we do that through education and outreach, enforcement, and public policy. So also to set some framework, really the laws and the main legal scheme that we're working under, we're not a law office, but we are, we're ensuring enforcement to the main federal, state, and local fair housing. So the main is the Fair Housing Act that was passed in 1968 and currently in its current state covers seven protected classes. So race, color, national origin, sex, disability, religion, and familial status. And then in Oregon, we have the additional protected classes of source of income, marital status, sexual orientation, and domestic violence survivorship. So those are the main protected classes that we work within. And our three departments within the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, education and outreach, provides trainings to housing providers and landlords throughout the state. Our public policy department monitors fair housing-based issues and helps try to shed light on the fair housing laws and advocate on issues that have fair housing implications, particularly around historical harm and protected class groups. And our enforcement group receives inquiries from throughout the state, and we respond to those inquiries in quite a few different ways, and I'll provide more context about that. So just to give you a sense too of how many inquiries we received statewide in the 2020 to 2021 year, we received over 1,300 inquiries throughout the state. And of those, 174 were bona fide allegations. What I mean when I say bona fide allegation is that they had fair housing implications in that they had a protected class at play, as well as an allegation under the statutory scheme of the fair housing laws. So those can be things like misrepresentations of availability, applying to an apartment based on protected class, neighbor on neighbor harassment or discrimination. So that's what I referred to when I mean a bona fide allegation. In the city of Portland, we had 269 fair housing inquiries, and of those, 52 were bona fide allegations. So we had a higher number in the city of Portland of allegations in relationship to how many inquiries we received. And some of that is likely attributed to the education efforts that we've had ongoing and relationship with entities like the city of Portland to ensure that education piece and that landlords know and tenants know their rights related to fair housing laws. So what we do when we receive these inquiries, we have a hotline, an email hotline that's open 24/7. Folks can always email us at information@fhco.org. We also have a phone hotline. That number is 1-800-424-3247, extension 2. And you can find all of this on our website, fhco.org. And we receive inquiries also from direct referrals, so partnering agencies from throughout the state. And partner jurisdictions from throughout the state who send us direct inquiries to either my email or to our information@fhco.org email. When we receive those inquiries, we conduct intakes to determine whether or not there's a bona fide allegation at play related to fair housing laws. And then we decide as an enforcement team what the best path forward is based on what the tenant or person reaching out to us wants to have happen. So our main routes of responding are both informal and formal processes. Our informal process includes writing advocacy letters to housing providers and landlords to inform them of the fair housing laws and to their obligations, and expressing concerns of situations arising where fair housing laws don't seem to be protected, and making asks on behalf of tenants for things like reasonable accommodations or for intervention where there is neighbor-on-neighbor harassment based on protected class. And then we have more formal processes too. So our formal processes include drafting complaints on tenants' behalf, and we submit those complaints both to the Department of Housing and Urban Development at the federal level and to the Bureau of Labor and Industries at the statewide level. And then at times we also help represent folks in those administrative processes. And we also conduct further investigations to support those complaints or to support legal action that we sometimes partner with private attorneys. And we have an attorney pool made up of private attorneys throughout the state that then we can partner with on cases to provide and hand off the investigations that we've conducted. So let's see, in that investigation realm, one of the things that we do is we conduct testing, and Honorbon will get into this in further detail. But in our testing, what we have the ability to do is send in secret shoppers and folks that then help to identify, you know, if we get an inquiry that someone in the pre-application phase of applying to an apartment thinks that they were treated differently based on race, we can send in a white applicant and a Black applicant to see if they received the same information. And the Supreme Court has held that that evidence can then be used to show different treatment in court cases. And that organizations can have standing too to be able to bring complaints alongside folks that have been harmed or tenants that have gone through those experiences. As I mentioned, we also partner with private attorneys. And in that context, You know, in some of the more egregious cases, we will reach out to our partnering attorneys and share the case, and then also kind of make a plan for moving the case through potential litigation. I can give an example of a case that we recently have filed, and you can find more information about this complaint online, but in the city of Portland area related to source of income and tenants being refused housing because they had a federal subsidy for rent assistance coming through a nonprofit, and a nonprofit that predominantly serves folks with disabilities related to HIV. And so we found that that outright denial of the 2-year secured source of income rent assistance was a pretty egregious example of source of income discrimination, as well as some disparate impact potential claims related to disability and to sexual orientation. So that's an example of a case that we had come through our office that seemed there was a lot of evidence around pretty distinct different treatment that we were able to then partner with private attorneys on. We also, in collaboration with the city of Portland and multiple other groups, through our testing reports that we partnered with the City of Portland Forum, we'll talk more about, and we'll also be joining you all in, I believe, October, November, to present on City of Portland. We also identified a couple of years ago that it seemed like there was an underreporting of cases based on national origin and race. And what we know is that likely those incidences are underreported because of historical harm and mistrust of reporting those incidences to government agencies or to, you know, semi-government funded agencies like ourselves. And so in partnership with the Urban League of Portland and in having conversations and identifying that it was likely underreporting of these national origin and race claims, we came to the City of Portland and we received fundings for the collaborative effort led by the Urban League and in partnership with ourselves for Housing Council, Legal Aid, and El Programa to help create an ability for direct referrals to come through culturally specific trusted partnering agencies to our legal entities to be able to then work together to create a legal plan and to respond to race and national origin claims. So along those lines, we've been able to expand on this collaborative approach where we meet as a group every month and do case management together. And it's really an incredible multifaceted approach to ensuring a trusted entity and advocate is with you from a culturally specific agency, while also partnering with the legal entities and being able to address multiple housing needs at once. So say, for instance, some of the culturally specific agencies receive funding as well for various types of housing resources, then we can partner as a group that our agency can represent the legal part, and the culturally specific agency can also help kind of navigate housing needs like finding housing or rent assistance. So that's another piece of enforcement effort that's been really remarkable. With that, I will hand it over to Honor Bond to speak a little bit further about our testing program and the importance of testing.
Thanks, Kristen. Hi, everyone. My name is Anirban Pant. I'm the testing and I'm one of the testing and enforcement coordinators at FHCO. So I was asked to talk very briefly about our fair housing testing program. What testing is, why we do testing, how do we do them, and different types of testing that we do. So what is testing? It's a means of means to uncover evidence of discrimination in the housing context. It happens in other contexts as well, and in employment contexts, other agencies are doing it, academic researchers are doing it. So now there is a long-standing testing has become a very standardized process across the country. We are part of a network of fair housing organizations throughout the country that do these kinds of tests. They're essentially, so our testers are essentially secret shoppers who respond to advertisements for rental housing And then they report back to us the information that was provided to them by the housing provider. And then we determine whether there was any different treatment that was offered to two testers who are identical in most profile attributes, except perhaps their membership to a particular protected class. Why do we do testing? Well, the nature of discrimination has changed. So we see less of overt slamming the door, saying that we don't rent to Blacks or to people with disabilities. We now see more covert discrimination. So it sometimes becomes hard for even a person who has been a victim of discrimination to know that they were treated differently based on a protected class. So like Kirsten mentioned, in 1982, in a landmark Supreme Court decision that approved fair housing testing as a legitimate way to uncover evidence of discrimination. So since then, this has become a very standard practice that many organizations are doing around the country. So how do we do them? We have a pool of trained testers, both here in Portland, and we try to recruit new testers throughout Oregon, wherever we are doing testing. They belong to different protected classes, so we have testers from different race, national origin, people with accent, foreign accent, and people of different religions. And we use these testers depending on the kind of test we are doing. We identify properties to test, either based on a complaint that we have received against a particular housing provider, or if it's a audit test, which I'll talk about soon, if we would go through Craigslist ad or through apartments.com ads and places where people generally post advertisements for housing. We do a vacancy check by calling them to see if there is a vacancy. We prepare, identify testers and prepare a script to give to our testers, which have a list of questions that they need to ask the housing provider. And then the testers contact the housing provider and report back to us in written reports what they were told about the availability or about attributes of the housing. And then we as test coordinators then gather these reports, compare these reports, and determine whether different treatment has happened and the nature of different treatment, and determine if there is any either enforcement action that needs to be taken. Then we follow up with those, or in some cases we write letters to the housing provider alerting that we tested them and that the test came positive, and that we might take enforcement action if they continue to discriminate people on the basis of a protected class. What are the different types of testing? Well, we do almost 95% of our tests are rental tests, but we also do a limited number of tests for in sales. So housing sales, we test real estate agents, both seller's agent and buyer's agent, to see whether they are discriminating on the basis of any of the protected classes. We test mortgage lenders, homeowners insurance providers, and we used to do design and construction tests, which are tests that are a specialized kind of test for disability as a protected class, to go and take measurements to see if a newly constructed housing unit is meeting all the standards of accessibility for a person on a wheelchair, for instance. So primarily mostly rental tests, but some of those advanced tests. We can also classify the kinds of tests we do based on whether they are complaint-based tests or they are audit tests. So complaint-based tests is where we have a complainant who comes and reports a case of housing discrimination. And then in the process of our investigation, we use testing as a means to gather more evidence in support of either bringing a case in partnership with a private attorney or to file an administrative complaint with either HARD or the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And the audit tests are to generally see if there are impediments that people looking for housing in a particular jurisdiction are facing because of a protected class. So complaint-based test is more for enforcement purposes, whereas audit testing is meant to find patterns of general impediments to access to housing based on a protected class for a particular jurisdiction. We just completed, as Kirsten mentioned, we completed our 2020-2021 City of Portland audit testing, and we are in the process of finalizing the report for that. So stay tuned, and we'll be presenting the findings of that report sometime in October or November. And the way we can classify these tests based on how we do these tests. So we can either ask our testers to make phone calls to housing providers and interact with them on the phone to find what information is provided. We do those kinds of tests mostly for source of income tests or national origin tests. So we would ask a tester who has a foreign accent to call a housing provider and then see what was told to that person versus another tester who is a native English speaker, for instance. We also do email tests, which we have been using a lot in the past year during the pandemic time. We are not able to send testers in person. So most of our race-based tests are where we send a white and a black tester to property to do tests so that it's clear to the housing provider the race of the person interested in the housing. We haven't been able to do that during the pandemic. We don't want to send our testers out to do tests when we ourselves are not returning to office yet. So we have used email as a way to do those kinds of tests where we have created email addresses. So Census Bureau publishes a list of most common African-American names, first names and last names. So we have created fake tester email addresses with those names that would easily convey the race of the person. We also add in the signature of the email a quote from a civil rights leader, say a quote from Malcolm X or Martin Luther King Jr. And in some cases, we also put a photograph of a Black person in the signature. So those are the ways by which we try to make it explicit that the person contacting is a Black tester, Black applicant versus another applicant who is a white applicant. And we also do, so in usual circumstances, we would do in-person tests for race-based tests. So that was all that I had prepared to talk about. If any of you have questions, I can take those, and otherwise I'll pass it to Alan for the next part of the presentation.
I actually do have just two quick questions. Sure. The first is, I was interested in that split of 95% of testing being done in the rental environment versus 5%, it sounds like, falling in home ownership. Is that just due to the funding sources that are available for testing, or is there another reason for that heavy percentage going towards
Yeah, it's primarily most of our jurisdiction funds that we get are for rental tests. So Portland Housing Bureau, we receive this grant to do audit tests, which are rental tests. And we also have other jurisdictional grants that are similar rental tests. The only grant that we have currently that pays for advanced tests like sales, mortgage lending, homeowners insurance are through HARD. So we do those HARD-funded advanced tests. And that's a very limited number compared to most of our other testing.
I'd also share that the part of that is also because those tests require a bit more time and design in terms of they're a bit more complicated in terms of, you know, comparing and applying. We also do mortgage lending. So going through that process of providing that information and designing those tests are a bit more detailed. So they're require more of our staff time. So that's part of why only one of our grants really covers it.
My other question was if you could just give the committee a general idea of what type of civil penalties a housing provider might face if they're found in violation, or, you know, can't get to any other sort of resolution or mediated agreement about how to address the issue during the process, and we've really got to take it all the way up. What does that look like for a housing provider, and what could that look like for the community member?
Yeah, so part of the one of the main modes that we work through in the administrative process with both HUD and BOLI does include providing a damages worksheet. So being able to determine what the harm is and monetary wise what people have experienced is part of what the process we go through with the administrative experience. You know, sometimes our intervention can include things like having an application re-reviewed and reconsidered in a place where they have, where an applicant was denied for, say, something like criminal history, or, you know, had an RA denied and then were denied the housing. So sometimes our interaction will be to change that outcome. And then in other cases, it is to, especially in the administrative process, to determine what the monetary damage and harm was and be able to help walk folks through that process to articulate that to HUD or BOLI.
And I think part of that is, you know, the Act doesn't prescribe sort of damages. It's not, you know, $100 per violation. And so it really depends on what the damage that was done in the violation, and that can be determined as part of a conciliation process or, you know, through a court process. You know, there are other statutes, local state statutes, that do prescribe, you know, sort of a dollar amount per violation. But, you know, for much of the work that we do, I think, and Kirsten, tell me if I'm framing that properly, you know, it really is that comes through the enforcement process and can be significant in some cases where the damage is extensive that has been done by the violations.
Yeah, and I can provide example. In the example I shared earlier with the couple that was denied housing based on their source of income through a nonprofit, in that instance, you know, they had to stay in a hotel for a period of time. So damages included hotel costs. They also, you know, were trying to move closer to the apartment that they were denied at, was close to their doctor's office, to their community, to family caregivers. So there were multiple layers of ways that they were harmed monetarily that were included within the damages and complaint process.
Mara also has a question, and I do just want to flag everyone for time. It's 4:07, and we do have public comment scheduled at 4:15. So I'll give a minute warning when that comes up, and we'll just pause if we are still in discussion or presentation. Mara?
No comment. Sorry about that.
Okay, it sounded like Alan still had part of the presentation. Is that correct?
Yeah, thanks, Nikki, and thanks for those questions. The only piece I was going to bring forward was that in addition to the work that we're for that's pertinent to this group, in addition to the work that we do with the Portland Housing Bureau, and then of course work that's supported by HUD at the federal level, we also this year are embarking on fair housing specific work with Multnomah County, and so extending the reach of our work, particularly out into the outer part of East County and East Portland. You know, I think violations of the Fair Housing Act don't really respect boundaries, but certainly jurisdictions do. And so it is an opportunity for us, as we know, you know, given the dynamics we've seen in the housing marketplace, for us to look into what's happening out in East Multnomah County and some of those areas there where that may have received less attention in the past. So we're grateful for that opportunity, and we'll be doing both education, enforcement, and including testing out in those areas of the city. So kind of expanding the horizons of the work that we're doing in these areas here.
Hi, this is Barbara on the phone. Can I ask a couple of questions, please? I'm sorry, couldn't hear.
Go ahead, Barbara.
Okay, hi. On testing, first of all, do you test for buildings or in buildings that have these long wait lists? I think I raised that once before, and I'm just wondering if you mentioned it and I missed it somehow. Okay. Do you do that? Have you, how is that accomplished? You know, so a building has a 2-3-4 year wait list for tenants.
Yes. Thanks, Barbara. Yeah, we do do tests in properties that have wait lists, and usually these are income restricted properties. So they're only you can be eligible for these housing only if your income is under a certain limit. So they usually have long wait lists, and we do tests there. We give a different set of script to our testers in those situations. We ask them to engage with the property manager or whoever they're talking to ask about the length of the wait list, about other processes, pre-application phase, what sort of information they are looking for to find if if the property management company is discriminating on the basis of a protected class. So we would find other alternative script to see whether if they are being told of a longer waiting time than a person who is not a member of a protected class, for instance.
Yes, or a more desirable tenant.
Right.
Can often circumvent those long waiting lists, and we know of and hear of tenants getting an apartment in a year and a half while someone else languishes for 4 years waiting. So, yeah. Okay, thanks. The second question I had was for Kirsten. I thought I heard, Kirsten, that you said that it was felt that race discrimination or discrimination based on national origin was underreported. Can you say why you think it's underreported, or why you thought it is underreported, please?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Barbara. And I might ask Alan for his perspective on this too, because he has more of the historical knowledge when we were
good.
Yeah. I also wanted to follow up. I was just reviewing tests yesterday and analyzing tests related to one of our grants, and had an example of a waitlist test where one applicant with a without a discernible accent was told 6 months for the waitlist, whereas the applicant with the discernible foreign accent was told over a year. And then we also see distinction between being given explicit information of how to get on the wait list being given to the non-protected class person versus the person protected class not being given that information. So that's a great question, Barbara, on that front. Thanks for asking. In terms of the race and national origin, you know, the largest number of inquiries we receive to our office based on protected class revolve around disability. And I think what we know is that it's not necessarily that folks with a disability are being discriminated against more. It's probably more likely that they just have received more information about how to, or potentially more advocacy or access to report those claims of discrimination. And so in conversations with culturally specific agencies like the Urban League and El Programa, you know, when we were talking about how many incidences they were seeing of folks coming into their doors that had experienced discrimination in the housing process, in either applying to or during their housing experience, what we were seeing is that likely our numbers weren't consistent with what was coming into the culturally specific agencies with trusted relationships and community. And so that's where we started to think, like, it does appear that our numbers related to what's getting reported to us are likely underreporting related to race and national origin, which makes sense when we look at historical harm and what has happened public policy wise, institutionally, with institutional racism, and has happened in terms of displacement or different things that have impacted communities of color, that it makes sense that folks are hesitant or may have less access to report incidences based on race and national origin. So I think that's part of what led us to want to try to address the issue and to ensure partnership with culturally specific agencies where there are those trusted relationships. I'll also share that, you know, I think as for differing reasons, you know, last year after the murder of George Floyd and the protests, we did see an increase in reporting to our office of race-based discrimination, particularly neighbor-on-neighbor harassment. And we spoke to attorneys in the employment realm who similarly said that they were seeing an increase in reporting, and heard from folks that that was because they felt stronger about reporting or having more access to do so with the issues being raised. So I think it does ebb and flow a bit more, and the relationship with culturally specific agencies is really crucial. Alan, are there pieces or historical parts to that that you'd add?
No, I think that's great, Kirsten. I really appreciate that. I know I'll just give a brief answer since I know we're getting up against time here. But the other thing I would say about it is that, as you said, Kirsten, it's not necessarily that more discrimination might be happening in one protected class or another. But for instance, in some of the protected classes, it's easier to tell when discrimination has occurred. For people that are living with disabilities, very often it is a question about an assistance animal or something like that that's been actually denied, right? We can actually have a housing provider that we can actually see that discrimination happening. Or families with children, right? They've been denied. We just heard a story about that based on having children. As Honorbon said, we don't very often these days see folks that say, we're not going to rent to you because you're Black or because you're Hispanic or Latinx, right? And so it becomes much more difficult to actually know that that's happened to you, which makes something like match pair testing an important opportunity to gather evidence like that.
Great, thank you. I'm just gonna put a pause on
thank
this
you.
Real quick, and we can jump back in. And it may not be too long. We did not have anyone registered for the public comment period that was pre-registered for the meeting. However, there may have been folks that joined us that did not register. So I do want to take a moment to pause here and offer that up as it is our scheduled time. Feel free to unmute, or you can put something in the chat, any members of the public that would like to provide comment.
This is Mara from ILR. I actually have a public comment on behalf of someone who provided some information to me and just wanted to forward that. I had encouraged them to come to this meeting, but they decided not to, but I've been having folks with visual disabilities basically test out all the different housing applications that pop up online. And we've just been seeing a lot of improvements to that. And folks are now able to more independently complete their own housing applications. We saw it happen with the Washington County Housing Choice Voucher that just opened. So it's some good news to see that community is feeling a little bit more included in the housing, affordable housing process. But yeah, so I just wanted to put that out there to some of the folks on this call.
Thank you so much for sharing. Does anyone else have any public comments to share? Okay, well, then we are now ahead of the agenda. So good news for us. I'll return back. Does anybody have any further questions? Or Barbara, did you want to jump back in and provide any follow-up to the answers provided by Alan and Kirsten or anything else related to Fair Housing Council of Oregon's presentation? Going once. Okay. I think we can go ahead and move on there. I did make some notes, but I do want to talk about next steps and kind of return back to the beginning of the meeting. We were talking about the HUD guidance and the new interim rules. So we have Matthew Schabold here to talk us through that and the implications. So Matthew, I will hand it over to you and we can do some discussion or questions after that, but it looks like we may be able to end the meeting about 10 minutes early.
Hey everybody, my update should be pretty quick. I guess just to take a step back to make sure that we're all working off the same foundation of information. Under the Trump administration, the requirements under the HUD's affirmatively furthering fair housing guidance were rolled back, and what had been the analysis of impediments and what was becoming the assessment of fair housing was no longer a requirement for jurisdictions around the country. And kind of, if you want to think about it in two components, it's really an assessment process and then identification of actions that local jurisdictions or any jurisdiction can take to affirmatively further fair housing. So the requirement to do the assessment of fair housing, which was the new process under the Obama administration, that requirement went away. And in its place, a local certification form needed to be completed, and that was the requirement. So I think many people on FHAC will recall that when we talked about this last year, FHAC said, well, regardless, we want to go ahead and pursue some sort of assessment of fair housing in Portland and or Multnomah County. And then we want to come up with our own recommendations for some fair housing actions that could be pursued in response to that assessment. Going through that process, the Bureau, we said that we would support you in that effort and we would help to staff that and provide any sort of data analysis and research work that you needed to develop those recommendations for the city of Portland. Well, what has happened, as Nikki mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, is we now have the Biden administration interim rule, which does not require an analysis of impediments or an assessment of fair housing, but it has re-provided the guidance for jurisdictions around the country. It has reproduced some of the data mapping tools, data analysis tools that had been removed, and it's reinstituting its technical assistance for jurisdictions in completing either the analysis of impediments or the assessment of fair housing for those that choose to do so. And as Nikki mentioned, we do anticipate, or at least we are hoping, that the Biden administration is moving in the direction to reestablish that requirement. So because of that, the Bureau is preparing to put together a team, a project team at the Bureau, in order to kind of map out a scope and a timeline to complete an assessment and develop action items. We do not have we don't have the capacity to do an FHAC process separate from an agency process to do two different assessments and two different action plan developments. And I think a lot of it would be too duplicative, and it makes sense to do it together. And so the update we wanted to provide is that we will be coming back at your next meeting to share with you our draft plan to put together an assessment and then fair housing actions that the city can commit to. That will also, the draft plan will include how we're involving the community in this process, how we're involving agencies in that process, as well as some thoughts that we have on how FHEC is involved in that process in terms of completing reviews of the various components of work that we're going to be developing and developing recommendations for the assessment part of the process and the action plan part of the process. So I know it's been a bit of a kind of unclear and stagnant year because of the change in administration. So just want to first say thank you to everyone for hanging in there. But now that we're starting to see the federal guidance move, we are preparing locally. And so FHEC will be a part of that process as we do that work at the Housing Bureau. So I'm happy to answer any questions. It does a little bit mean that this affects your work plan. Hopefully that's okay with folks, but I think in the end, we'll get a better product and a better set of recommendations. So yeah, with that, that's all the time I need. Lots of thumbs ups from zoomed out people, so. Great.
Okay, well, if anyone does have any questions regarding that slight change in direction, feel free to reach out. It is 4:24, so it is a bit earlier than 5, but I think we made it through all the agenda items and had some good discussion in there. So unless somebody has anything else that they would like to discuss or bring to the attention of the committee, I will just have a few reminders and sign us off. Mara, I see a hand up.
Hey, sorry, Chatty, I apologize. I was wondering about, I'm excited for guidelines and clarification, but also just want to make sure like this committee is still going to have some space to make some decisions on our own about things we may want to support or push forward or that kind of thing. Or is it more like this will really tell us what we're going to do and what we need to focus on?
I'll answer that one. So it is FHEC will definitely have the opportunity to say, great, we see the city's assessment and we think also we need to be looking at these data points or these sets of analyses. And then when we get to the action item recommendation stage, this body may say, okay, we see what the Bureau is proposing that it can, or the city is proposing that it commit to on action items, but also Bureau and City Council, FHEC is recommending these, or potentially, I guess, not recommending some things, but FHEC is recommending, in addition to what is being committed to in this plan that the Bureau and the city have developed, the city should pursue these additional things. And we will take that to council with the assessment and action items that we do ourselves.
That makes complete sense. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I just wanted to express appreciation, Matt, for where you all are headed. You know, I think this is, you know, given the winding road we've been on, you know, I think this is the place that we were hoping we would end, right? And I appreciate the city's and the Bureau's commitment to all of that and the commitment for the work of this group here. And I think that, you know, that's something that this group can mirror back to the Bureau in being committed to really looking at what elements of it, of the plan are and the action plan are important to members of the communities that we all work with. So, you know, we're looking forward to that process, but yeah, I think that's the direction that we were all headed and hope to be heading down the line here. So let's hope we don't see any more turns in the road coming up, but we think the future is ahead of us.
Great, okay, well, just a few reminders then to please keep an eye out for the event invite with the Zoom details that will be coming from Ryan. Please also keep an eye out for information on recruitment for a new committee member that I will be sending out to you folks and push that forward to your networks. For things that you can send me, if you feel so inclined to volunteer for the chair or the vice chair position, please shoot me a quick email and let me know that you're interested, and then I can follow up with you on next steps there. Also, if you have any suggested organizations or specific contacts that you would like to ensure are included in the outreach plan when we do recruitment for a new committee member, please send me an email regarding that as well. And with that, it is 4:27, and we will call the meeting done, and I will see all you folks in October.